like to bring the House Committee on General Government and Consumer Protection to order. It is February 8th.
Thanks, Mayor.
We've got a few bills on our agenda today. We're not going to be going in the order that they appear on the agenda. We're going to be starting with House Bill 4131. Then we're going to do 4091, 4001, and last but not least, 4111. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4131. And Jan, could you give us a brief description of the bill?
Yeah. Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 4131 was heard by the committee last Wednesday, and this is the bill that addresses the ratio of state agency employees to the ratio of employees to supervisors. We had the hearing on that. Now before you today, you have the Dash 4 amendment, which sets up a procedure in which by October 31st, the agency is to increase their ratio by one employee and each subsequent year to continue to increase that by one employee until the ratio of 11 to 1 is met. And it exempts the legislative, judicial branches. It exempts the Secretary of State and State Treasurer. You also have the Dash 5 amendment. It is the same amendment as Dash 4, but instead of an October 31st date, it has a December 31st date. And the Dash 6 amendment simply exempts the legislative branch, judicial branch, Secretary of State, and State Treasurer. We are waiting, on this bill, we have the fiscal statements. They are what we call the light statements. It's basically saying that they'll do further analysis if the bill is referred to Ways and Means, and there is no revenue impact on the bill or the amendments.
Thank you. So, committee, up first, I'd like to have Michael Dimbro come up. He wanted to provide us a little testimony on the amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-chairs, honorable colleagues, first of all, I want to say I appreciate being able to come before you to speak to these amendments, and also thank you for accommodating my schedule and putting this up first. I also appreciate the input from the committee when we first talked about this last week and hearing the concerns of the committee, and I believe that these amendments address those concerns and specifically address the twin needs of the need for increased certainty, but at the same time, some increased time to allow the agencies the time to come up with the necessary savings and to do it right. As many of you know, along with my many years as a teacher, I've also spent many years doing collective bargaining work at Portland Community College, and I've been involved in numerous, if not countless, processes dealing with position reductions or entire program reductions. It's never easy to do this. But there are good ways to do it, and there are not so good ways to do it. We want to make sure that we're doing this in the right way. My goal in these processes has always been to do it in a way that mitigates as much as possible the impact on individuals and on the organization. I've always preferred to make the changes through attrition when possible, but when it isn't possible, through a process that gives affected individuals adequate notice and puts the focus on putting primacy on the quality of services that we're going to be able to continue delivering to students and clients, you know, in that world. What's most important for everyone throughout such a process, of course, is clarity, transparency, and certainty. And so to that end, we have these amendments which do the following things. You know, first of all, clarifies that agencies that have not yet reached the 11-to-1 target ratio are immediately barred from filling a vacant position, a vacant supervisor position, as needed to increase their ratio by one. Okay? The hope is that the agencies will be able to do that through attrition alone. But if come October 31st, they have not been able to increase their ratio by one through attrition alone, then they'll have to do layoffs. Okay. Moving that date to October 31st is going to give the agency some more flexibility. It'll give the affected individuals 6 months' notice. I think in both cases that's a good thing. The layoffs happen, of course, will have to be done under the terms of a collective bargaining agreement. My understanding is that some of these supervisors might have begun their careers as part of a bargaining unit, and they retain rights to their position if they end up losing their supervisor position. So they may have to do some bumping as a result of that. I will say I did check with the affected union, SEIU, whether they are okay with that, with some of their current members ultimately being bumped as a result of this process, and they assured me that their focus is on getting to the proper ratio, that they do understand and accept that. The amendments clarify that any managers who are reclassified into classified positions will be paid according to the appropriate salary schedule for that unit that they will be moved into. And that takes us through the first year. Agencies that by the end of October 31st have still not reached their 11-to-1 target will be prevented from filling vacant positions. That bar will continue until they have been able to increase by a further one, which they have a year to do through attrition again. But if by October 31st of 2013 they have not been able to improve their ratio by one, then they will have to do further layoffs, and so forth until they are able to hit the 11-to-1 target. So again, colleagues, this is an effort to create more certainty, but at the same time gives the agencies a high degree of flexibility, I believe. And I'd be very happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, thank you for working on this bill. And maybe you're not the right person. I'll ask the question. If you don't have the answer, maybe somebody behind you. But the ORSs that speak to basically taking a classified employee or an unclassified employee and filling it, basically going backwards, there's some specific language in there. And I'll read this language, and then I'll ask, I guess, the question. Management service employees with immediate prior, and I think this is what your point was, with immediate prior former regular status in a classified service may be dismissed only for these specific reasons. So basically, this is saying that a manager that is being reclassified to a classified employee has to be able to do that. In other words, they have to go from here to here, and based on bargaining issues down here, then somebody else who's the last person hired gets laid off.
That's correct.
Okay. Was there any discussion about removing that particular statute or clause so that when managers are making these decisions, when directors are making these decisions, there may be somebody who's not as effective as a current classified employee in that position who is very productive and is doing that, so that maybe there is some deadwood out there that in these mid-management positions that could literally be laid off without having to bump other people? It's a simple statute. Was that talked about being removed at all?
It was not talked about, and I think I would have problems with it if the individual in taking the management job, took the management job with the understanding that they would still have a classified job waiting for them if that at-will position went away, you know, which is kind of what we're looking at. I mean, my sense would be for that a deal is a deal. So, you know, I think I could see addressing that prospectively, you know, as the collective bargaining agreements being rebargained, or the individual agreement with the, you know, the classified who goes into management is being negotiated. But to go back and do it, my sense is that would be a problem. So you see what I mean?
Sure.
I'm sorry,
so follow up for me. Yeah. So you would be in agreement to set a date to remove that statute, that here forward it would allow a director to have that flexibility at some point out into the future?
You know, I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I'm not really conversant with, you know, with that statute, because, you know, I've not worked directly with state workers in that way. You know, in my world, that would have been covered by a collective bargaining agreement. And, you know, so I think that, you know, as long as the, you know, the principals had the ability to handle this matter through collective bargaining, that would be my preference. But, you know, certainly I would, you know, encourage that issue being put on the table.
Just for clarification, this is statute, not collective bargaining. Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, Representative Clem, I didn't see you down there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that same issue, one thing I just wanted to, I looked into this quite a bit, and I had a priority bill one session, actually, to make people at will under certain economic conditions, because I was hearing testimony from management that they were a little, they really didn't want to eliminate certain positions because they were going to end up bumping someone right down to one of the, and taking out one of their best employees, so they ended up stuck. So I actually had a bill to deal with this, and I was talking with a few senators who are still interested in this issue. LC told us this is sort of an absurd interpretation, I thought, but they said that somehow it's been deemed under U.S. constitutional law that the job is property, and you cannot be denied property without some sort of process, and so we wouldn't be able to just pass a law making them at will. I thought that seemed a little crazy, but it's a pretty complicated deal, and I still am interested in it, and we have some Senate colleagues who are quite interested in trying to pursue a way to get at this, because my point of view is once you leave the bargaining unit and go into executive service, you know full well you're going to an at-will situation, and you know, I don't know that you really, I don't believe you should get bumping rights back, especially not prospectively, or we could do it prospectively, but there's a huge, weird legal issue around your job as property that I don't think we could probably deal with as an amendment to this bill, but I'll still work with you on trying to hunt it down, because I tried this one session and someone shot me right between the eyes down at Legislative Council.
So I was wondering if we could get Donna Bennett to come
hey,
up. And
we can hold a question. Is Michael going to leave?
No,
he's going to stay.
I can stay for a few more minutes.
If she's willing to come up, I suppose, you know, to help provide some clarity to some of the statements. Representative Wisnant, did you have a question for Michael Dambro?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm just going to thank Michael for bringing the bill forward, working with us, and also I think the workers and the union that agreed to do this. And I would ask Representative Dimbro, if he would make for the record, you know, I think the co-chairs are looking, and we've talked about this could produce a savings of $20 million. Would he like to state or confirm that?
That's what I've heard, Co-Chair Wisnant, Co-Chair Holvey. I've heard that the savings can be anywhere between $16 million and $21 million. You know, it's... to be honest, I don't know what the effect will be of moving the requirement date to October, but, you know, my sense is, my hope anyway, is that by making the, you know, the bar on filling vacant positions effective upon passage, that we'll get some savings that way, which will off-balance the moving it to October.
And a follow-up statement? Thank you, Ms. Having served the military for 27 years and been involved in a lot of situations where reductions and bumping and everything, and it's not a pleasant situation, but it's the system and the way it works. And again, but this bill, what we've done is we're eliminating a situation where only workers and people who actually deliver the services, you're saying, are eliminated, and managers or supervisory positions are kept, and by following a ratio and working towards that ratio of span of control. So again, thank you.
Any other questions? This Ms. Bennett, I was curious if you'd care to comment on you know, some of the statements, and especially Representative Cameron's question, you know, as you see the whole issue of eliminating the management positions.
Let me
four.
Mr. Chairs, let me just respond in general and then take additional questions if you wish. There are executive service employees with the state. They work at the pleasure of the appointing authority. Those are directors, the attorneys. I am also executive service. I have no property right in my job. I am at will. That is a very thin layer, if you will, of state service. Under that comes management service, and they have rights under ORS 540, the state personnel spurl laws, or what we call them. As a management service employee with the state, they have a property right, as you mentioned, Representative Clem, in their position, and that is granted by the Oregon Constitution. It has nothing to do with the U.S. Constitution. That was a case years ago, and I won't digress too much. It's the attorney in me that feels compelled to tell you that it is a U.S. case that says states have the right to bestow a property right on their employees, and Oregon has done that by statute. And then following under management service are those individuals who belong to collective bargaining groups or are unclassified, don't belong to bargaining groups. That's sort of the strata, if you will, of state service. So when one says that you can eliminate a manager because they are at will, that is not correct. They have rights under 240, specifically 240.570. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question,
sir? Thank you. And if you would identify yourself for the record.
My name is Donna Sandoval Bennett. I am the Chief Human Resource Manager for the state. And let me say, just prior to that, I worked at the Department of Justice, and prior to that, I was the head of the Employment Relations Board, so I'm familiar with SPURL.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So help me understand, and I'm a enormous fan of this bill, but just help me understand, at what stage do those rights vest? Is it because of collective bargaining, they sign a contract that says, hey, by the way, if you ever get bumped up and then we try to eliminate the position, you'll be able to bump somebody back down? Or is it in another section of statute that just says anytime somebody is elevated from a frontline worker to management service, then their same bumping rights are retained? What's the derivation of those property rights other than the Constitution and baseline statute?
Mr. Chairs and Representative Smith, that right, that restoration right, if you will, is vested in ORS 240.570.
Thank you.
Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I just want to be clear here. So if we have a, well, we'll take my world if you don't mind, firefighters. Generally, the firefighters are covered by up through lieutenant and captain through the collective bargaining agreement, so they've become a classified group, if you will.
Yes, sir.
You promote to battalion chief, and now you're out of the bargaining unit, which, you know, may or may not, we could argue whether that's a supervisory position or not, based on impact of economic discipline, but for the most part, the argument's been made that they should be out of the bargaining unit and become, at this point, at-will employee. Mm-hmm. If all of a sudden a entity decides we are no longer going to have battalion chiefs, if the collective bargaining agreement specifically states that employees outside the bargaining unit are not allowed to bump back into rank, does the collective bargaining unit, does that agreement then supersede the ORS, or does the ORS kick in? How would that work?
Well, let me tell you that in the context of state. First off, Mr. Chairs and Representative Matthews, let me say that a manager a classified, a union member who goes up into management, they have a right to restoration to their previous classified job in perpetuity with the state of Oregon. I can tell you an example a couple years ago where we were working with a gentleman who was removed from management service, and he had a right to go back to his previous classified position that he held 16 years earlier. That job didn't even exist any longer, but he had that right, and we had to find a position for him. So there is no time frame in which you go into management service and say, for example, if you're in management service for 6 months, you don't have restoration rights. We don't have that with the state, sir.
Mr. Chair, just quick follow-up.
Go ahead.
If it was covered in a collective bargaining agreement, and I'm not suggesting that's the way it is in the state, but if it were covered in the collective bargaining agreement, if that was defined as not being available, would that hold up then, or would they always have the right to restore to the previous classified position?
Mr. Chairs and Representative Matthews, let me say that is a speculative question because there is no collective bargaining agreement within the state that prohibits restoration rights. You could certainly create that, sir. It doesn't exist now.
And I think it would be great if you and I might be able to just talk offline, because I want to get further clarification on how this impacts. Several agencies are going through a number of cuts. They're kind of contacting me, asking me some questions. I'd like to just get further clarification offline. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I appreciate this this information because I was actually not aware that, you know, that there was statute for state workers on this. I will say that, you know, over my many years of negotiating contracts, you know, we did often get proposals to give individuals that kind of property right once they moved into management, and I always resisted those. I didn't think it was good for the organization, and just in response to Representative Cameron, I would certainly be happy to work with you on, you know, looking at those statutes for future action.
Other comments, questions? Representative Cameron's been waiting for a while to.
That's okay. This is a very, very interesting topic that that has come up. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And you'd mentioned two things: one, property rights, and you first said by constitution, and then you said by statute. So,
Mr. Chairs and Representative Cameron, this is sort of probably gives you more than you're ever going to want as an answer, but let me give it to you as succinctly as I can. Oregon statute bestows a property right to one's public service job. That is by law. And you have it by and that is
ORS.
That's 240-570. If you look in ORS 240, you will see that. And then the collective bargaining agreements also have some very specific rights for their members with regard to layoffs, discipline, discharge, those contract rights.
Follow up if I may, and I just want to be real clear here. What I'm trying to get at is, directors are going to have to make decisions based on this bill to not fill or eliminate middle management positions, and I'm not trying to get down here in the collective bargaining rights down here. What I want to do is how do we give the directors the most flexibility in dealing with this, because this is two things. Representative, I appreciate this bill. One is to reduce, you know, overhead that maybe is needless, but also to improve productivity and that we keep the right people and not displace people who are down here in collective bargaining units doing a great job and make them leave our state while somebody else is there. So I want to, if you can just, so 240-570 is the statute that deals with that
those rights to the management person, right?
245.70, Mr. Chairs and Representative Cameron, that deals with how you remove someone from management service, the process in which it's done, and what their appeal rights are. Each of these individuals that might be removed from management service, they have an appeal right to the Employment Relations Board.
Okay.
Representative Smith.
So I read it. It's helpful. It doesn't say one of the things that we're saying that something says. So what it does say is that the that a classify after employee is terminated, et cetera, the that person may, at the agency's sole discretion, restore the employee to position held in the agency before the appointment, if the employee meets the position requirements. If an employee is restored to a former position, the employee is subject to any applicable agency collective bargaining agreements, which either means the source of the property rights you're talking about are another statute, and I looked at the rest of 245.70, the other subs, it's not there, or it vests because of the collective bargaining agreement at the first instance. Now, I don't expect I'm going to get fully to the bottom of this for my own comfort in the next however many minutes we're going to be doing this hearing. I do think it's an interesting enough question for us to delve into. The other thing I would say to Representative Cameron and anybody else is, from what I can tell at this point, it is a thorny enough question that it deserves its own conversation, and probably isn't, I don't think, a good enough reason to stall to stall this, because even if we just stall it a year, that's saving, let's say $20 million, overly optimistic, $5 to $15 million. So I hope we will still be able to move the bill, and I'm open to engaging in this conversation to the extent anybody wants to have it. But let me at least pose a question. Is there another statute?
Do you have to?
Is there another statute is there another section I should be looking at that says the right to retain bumping rights after you're removed from classified employment, you become management service employment, and then that position is eliminated, therefore you now have a statutory right, not a collective bargaining right, but a statutory right to retain bumping rights. Is there something other than 245.70 where I can find that?
Mr. Chairs and Representative Smith, what you have here is codified in ORS 245.70, and that says to one, you as a manager who have been removed from your position have a right to go back to where you were in classified status.
And that statute, and then, says at the agency's sole discretion.
I will tell you, sir, that is a sacred past practice. I will say that in the 10 years that I have been an attorney with the state of Oregon, I have never seen an agency not allow someone's restoration rights.
Granted, and don't contest that. I just want to know where it's coming from, because it's not coming from that, because that says agency's sole discretion.
Right.
So it's got to come from somewhere else. Past practice is one derivation. Other derivation is collective bargaining agreements. Another is, it's a big book. It could be somewhere else in the book, and I'm open to look.
There's a bunch of them back here.
I know, there's like a whole shelf.
Printed in Missouri.
Not even in this state.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving away from the big books back behind me a little bit, because it's kind of intrigued me a little bit with the bumping, with management bumping down. When they bump down, do we have set salary ranges for positions that we hold? Or would they're making $110,000 a year and they bump to a $40,000 to $60,000 a year job, do they get paid the $110,000?
Yes. Mr. Chairs and Representative Widener, they will typically go back into the salary ranges of their collective bargaining agreements for their particular job classifications. So they will sustain a salary loss.
May I follow up? So they will sustain a salary loss?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Well, I might let Representative Dimbro respond too, because addressed in the amendment.
Right, we did address this specifically. Thank you, Rep. Holvey and Rep. Widener. We addressed this specifically. If you look at the amendment on page 2, starting on line 17, it says, a supervisory employee or managerial employee acting in a supervisory capacity who is reclassified into a classified position pursuant to this section shall be compensated in the salary range for the classified position. unless otherwise provided by an applicable collective bargaining agreement. And my understanding is the collective bargaining agreement does not give that right, or does not make that requirement that they keep their management salary.
Thank you. Appreciate the clarity, and certainly there are some other surrounding topics. Appreciate you bringing the bill forward, and helping us figure out how to make our government more efficient and perhaps save some money.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
Good bill must pass. Thank you.
Monster should.
So, do we have anybody else left to testify?
Nobody signed up to testify.
No one else signed up to testify. So, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4131 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4091. Later.
I have to go.
With that, I'd like to bring up Representative Nathanson. Thank you for your patience. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13. I very much appreciate your scheduling a public hearing on this today, and I appreciate being able to talk to you at previous times about this topic, so I'm not going to repeat my testimony from previous hearings, although in some cases it may set the stage for people in the audience who haven't heard it. I will just say briefly that my interest has always been in the business of government and making it as efficient and effective as possible, and this bill started out as one of those to make us our processes as efficient as possible, and it's not addressing the policy. There are well-established policies why and under what circumstances we do criminal background checks, but the way we do them may not be the most efficient way we could, which is resulting in a loss of time and money for businesses and individuals as well as the state. So the key questions for me were, can we identify some standard components of background checks and procedures? Can we design processes to do this better? Can we organize the work so that it's more streamlined? And can we help save money, not just for the state, but for the people who are paying for the background checks, whether it's individuals or an organization? And I believe the answer is yes, we can make things better, and we should start doing it right now. There are several people who are signed up to testify, and I'll let them speak briefly themselves for the situations that they find themselves in that I think provide the compelling evidence that what we've got now is not actually a system. The state has, I believe it's over 50 separate agencies and commissions who have adopted their own procedures, processes, and in some cases you might even call it policies, but certainly processes for how they do background checks. That is not a system. That's a bunch of separate different things happening, and you'll see how it impacts individuals in a few minutes, because sometimes they have to get repeated background checks, even though it's the same person working with virtually, and in one case you're going to see the testimony with literally the same person. You have written testimony from someone named Sarah Dineen. I'm not going to read the whole letter. You have it, and you can refer to it, but I do want to point out one thing that is in this letter at the bottom of it, and I will quote from Ms. Dineen's letter. Of course, the irony is that I had worked continuously with this same child every week for 4 years and had been employed by a state-funded agency the entire time also. As a result, and this is my comment, because she was asked to do additional background checks. As a result, I had delays in being able to provide and be paid for services this child needs, and both I and the state of Oregon have incurred additional costs. Same person, same kid, had to get a new background check. So with that, I would just encourage you to look favorably on House Bill 4091, and I hope you'll let this process of fixing it and creating a more organized, efficient system move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and staying after this topic. It is a big one and much more complex than it appears on the surface. Committee, we have several amendments, and I do not believe we're going to move this bill particularly today. But I wanted to have Jan kind of run through the amendments that we have real quick, because I know she can do it real quick. Mm-hmm. And then we'll continue the conversation.
Okay. Do you want me to wait until that so we can just ask her a question before she gets dismissed?
Representative Nathanson, would you entertain a question that's evidently not pertaining to the amendments at this point from Representative Smith?
Yes.
And the question is not urgent, but your calendar might be, and I want to be sensitive to that. The vagaries of our relatively absurd process for having discussions where we only consider what's deeply affecting the state when we have a binary yes or no question before us, right? So it makes it nearly impossible to get to the hard part in any normal measure, by any normal measure. Something that I was hoping to connect to here that we talked about yesterday in the Ways and Means Subcommittee that you run is linked to, you know, having 50 different processes for background checks. When we heard from Mike Jordan, head of DAS, chief operating officer for the state, that we may have, or at least do have, a fundamental problem with the organization of state government. Whether it's an inevitable problem, could only be cured by things that would be worse problems, remains to be seen. And that is, if we have 96 state agencies, to say nothing of boards and commissions, with a single direct report, and most human beings can't keep sort of 96 relationships or sets of relationships in their head at the same time and function very well, I guess I'm wanting us to be thinking about that. One of the biggest things we have to be thinking about is not only piece by piece, how do we get processes similar across, but how do we think we want to be structuring state government. And the reason I want to say it now, and I apologize, Mr. Chair, but the reason I want to say it now is it's related to the conversation we were just having, which is maybe what we heard from Mike Jordan yesterday was to make state government manageable, to make, as he said, the corporate process, corporate structure of the state manageable. He did not use these words, but maybe what you need is more layers of management, right? So if you have one person and 96 direct reports, well, no, let's say everybody should have 12, right? So then that person has 6 direct reports, and that person has some direct reports, and that works out well. The discussion we've just been having is about reducing management. Now, we're talking about management service, not executive service, and I understand and appreciate the distinction. But I'm hoping that's on our brains, not just how we're going to vote yes or no on bills, but how the hell are we going to get the government working well, rather than just to kind of accreting policy as we do every 2 years or two decades, and then hoping that it makes sense, but don't worry, somebody else will get elected governor and promise to fix it and then won't.
And did you have a question?
Nope. Yes, please respond.
What do you think about that?
What do you think about that? I would actually love your thoughts on this as you've been thinking about it.
I had to ask.
Okay.
That was helpful. That was helpful.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, some of you who are familiar with me know that I usually am on script and have thought about what I want to say and have an outline of the points I want to make. This is off script, but I do have some thoughts. Indeed, the business of managing state government is very difficult because, in Mr. Jordan's words, appearing before the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government yesterday, he said, we have a flat structure. The governor's in charge for the entire executive branch, but it's the governor. Every agency and department is, in a way, sort of autonomous. They develop administrative rules. They develop budgets. They design processes. And just through two or three experiences where I've been digging in very deeply, whether it was formerly the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, where, you know, we have had four separate state systems for communications. They weren't required to work with each other. It, you know, at first, my first reaction is, why do we have four sets of people who have to learn how to maintain the communication towers and four sets of people who have to learn how to do this and that and the other? It's about technology as well as fixed assets and equipment. So whether it was that, whether it was an issue that I raised a year or so ago about our procedure of internal audits in state government, as it turns out, we have some nice ideas about how agencies ought to work together or ought to talk with each other or collaborate, but in fact they don't have to. And I've had more than one department head tell me privately, you know, it's very difficult when you ask us to do something and cooperate with other agencies because we don't have to. It depends on the personalities at times. The degree of enthusiasm and resources you bring to bear to how can we fix this, how can we work together. It's unfortunate for the legislature to be in the position of doing some of the bills that we do. Some people have said, why do you do these bills? You know, it's kind of what I get involved in sometimes is viewed as boring because it's the business of government rather than policy. Well, I get involved because it's very important how we use our money if we're to optimize our resources and use them to deliver services to citizens. So I think that until the business of managing the state government is a little more clear who reports to who, sometimes the legislature may find itself in the position of doing something that in some other state or some other corporate structure may say, we're micromanaging. You don't usually have a board of directors of a corporation going in, digging into the weeds of how departments are run, saying, we think you need to change your software in this system, or we think you need to buy cars in a different way in the way you're contracting for your motor pool. But we are getting involved in the business of running the government, I think to some extent, because of this relatively flat structure. And we're trying to find ways to provide instructions to the executive branch how to work together.
Thank you. Topic matter, you know, is very interesting and does relate to the bill somewhat. I was wondering about the germaneness of this conversation and worried about the efficiency of this particular committee in moving forward at this point. So any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair, no question, just one further comment, Representative, and I really appreciate what you said. And in there you said, we don't have to. I think they need to listen to that country western song that says, I get to.
Thank you for that anecdotal piece of information. thank you so much. Up next, I'd like to have Jan Aho.
He gets to.
Becky Strauss, and we'll wait for the other two.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hovey and WISNAT. I appreciate having the opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 4091. My name is Jan Aho, as I said, and I was the director of Probuck Preschool in Eugene, a position I held from September 1994 until I was hired as executive director of Probuck Center in 2010. During my time as director of the preschool, I was frustrated by the cumbersome, often confusing, and sometimes costly steps needed to secure criminal records checks for our staff. The situation has not changed. Criminal records checks are crucial for our organization and those who access our programs. Therefore, I welcome a more streamlined, cost-effective, centralized system that functions better not only for the employees, but also for the organization and ultimately the vulnerable population we serve. As Pearlbeck Center serves adults with intellectual developmental disabilities and young children whose parents have cognitive limitations, they are all in the same building. Our employees, substitutes, and some volunteers have to complete two background checks. They have to complete one for the child care division and one from DDMH system. Each department requires different paperwork. The child care division records check requires a fee of $3. Pearl Buck Center employees also have to complete a 301AD form for the DDMH system. There is no fee attached to the background check for the adults. Criminal records checks are not transferable from one state agency, department, program, school district to another. An employee who worked at a school district, foster care, or similar agency in Oregon and did have an FBI check or criminal records check through the state police at the other organization is required to submit new paperwork. The exception is that a new employee who is already on the child care registry does not have to reapply until their renewal date. New employees seeking clearance from the DDMH who have been outside Oregon for 6 months any time during the last 5 years have to go through an FBI background check that costs $60. The rule for the child care division is if you've been outside Oregon for 6 months within the last 18 months, an FBI check is required. If your mind isn't already boggled, it should be. That's not in my testimony. Delays are not uncommon, which can be challenging when trying to fill critical direct care positions. Two fingerprint cards are also required for FBI checks at a cost of $12 per card. So every time you have to do another FBI check, you're out $24. As you can see, the system is cumbersome and in need of streamlining. Therefore, I fully support House Bill 4091, as do other service providers that I've talked to in Eugene and Springfield. I especially want to thank Representative Nathanson and also Representative Hovey, who is a co-sponsor, for listening to our concerns when they came to our agency over a year ago when we were talking about efficiencies that we saw could be built into the system at a time when we were facing such serious cuts in the programs. I just want to end up saying we welcome the day when there is a unified, efficient criminal records check in Oregon, and I think House Bill 4091 goes a long way toward that. Thank you.
Thank you. And committee, I am going to take a moment here. I was remiss in not having Jan describe to you the amendments that are before us, because I know the next testifier will want to speak to one of those specifically. So, Jan.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just a reminder that the original bill is directing DAS to convene a work group to make recommendations on the criminal records check system and to report to the Legislative Assembly by November of this year. The DAS 3 amendment is going to add a member to the work group, and it is a person who is representing the privacy rights of individuals. The DAS 5 amendment came from Representative Hoyle. It is an amendment that's directing DHS to apply for a grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and the grant is to set up a wrap-back notification system for criminal records checks. Mm-hmm. The DAS 6 amendment is broadening the scope of the work group. As it is currently written, it was to look at people who are getting criminal records checks because they are licensed by the state. And so that's coming out, and it's also going to have the work group consider looking at some, if they're using an alternative source for getting criminal records checks, to look at the cost and quality of those. And then the final amendment, the DAS 9, it would allow OSP to retain the fingerprint cards and the results of the fingerprint of the criminal records check for up to 5 years, but it allows a subject individual to opt out of having those records and the fingerprint card retained. That's it.
Thank you. And I probably know too much about these amendments, but does anyone have any questions for Jan? Jan, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
For trying to help us make things more efficient and cost less. Next up, Becky Strauss, if you'd introduce yourself for the record,
sure.
Please.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Becky Strauss. I'm here representing the ACLU of Oregon. we are in support of the bill as introduced and in support of the Dash 3 amendments. I would hope that the ACLU of Oregon is that representative of folks with privacy rights and the rights of Oregonians to their privacy. To that end, we are opposed to the Dash 9s, and so I want to just take a minute to focus on those, particularly the provision in the Dash 9s that would allow for the department to retain fingerprint cards for 5 years of those who have submitted them for the background check. As I come onto this organization and get up to speed on the issues, I've seen a lot of history, a lot of participation in these issues over the years from the ACLU, particularly in 2005. House Bill 2157 instituted a lot of the ability of agencies to connect with the police, run the fingerprint checks, and one of the central concerns at that time for the ACLU, and the only reason that we were really able to not strongly oppose the new structure at that time, was this provision about the destruction of fingerprint cards. It's extremely important to privacy rights that the government not hold a database of innocent people's fingerprints, particularly when just that alone, but I'm not seeing anything in the bill that would limit the police access to those records once they're sitting somewhere as well, and that's a concern. I really, truly do appreciate the efforts of Representative Nathanson and of this committee to address government efficiency and looking for ways to find cost savings. We do hope to be a part of that conversation, but I think this provision in the Dash 9s of the retention of fingerprints is much, much more than a temporary band-aid, and I think this is something that needs to be fleshed out as the stakeholder group moves forward. I hope we can be a part of that conversation and figure out ways that we can save the state some money. So I appreciate that. We're in support of the bill, but cannot support it with the Dash 9s. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions?
Just one from myself. I appreciate your testimony and your concerns, and as we looked at these issues, really trying to figure out how we can reduce the redundancy and talking with the state police and some of the FBI requirements, it did appear to us that we really needed to figure out some way to retain the fingerprint records so we don't have to get brand new ones every time. But I appreciate that maybe that isn't totally flushed out at this point, and I'm sure the committee will take that into consideration as we move forward with this. So anyway, I appreciate your position.
Question or comment?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. As one who worked real hard in 2005 and 7 on fingerprinting, I understand the issue you're talking about. I have a question. In the amendment, it says there's an opt-out. In other words, that'll be obvious to me as a person who's going in for a background check that I can opt out to have my fingerprints held. Does that help? That's the first question.
Co-chairs, Representative Cameron, to be honest, it's still very worrisome. We have, an opt-out structure is complicated, and I have some questions about how that information is tracked, how is a person notified that they can opt out, and in what manner is that retained going forward that they have opted out. That the Dash 9s leave it to rulemaking to flesh a lot of this out is also a concern. So some of those sidebars would be nice to see, but to answer your question directly, I don't think that the opt-out provision gets us to a place where that we're okay.
That was my attempt to get him there.
Follow up with him. Thank you. Facial recognition. What's the difference between fingerprints and facial recognition records?
Co-chairs, Representative Cameron, that's out of my area of expertise, and I'd love to kind of think about that and speak with you.
Thank you.
We are concerned about facial recognition technology as well.
Representative Widener.
Oh, you're daring today. So,
A short question, please.
It's a short question, just something to think about, and this is kind of being echoed into the back of the room to where Representative Nathanson is, but I'm wondering if we should look into this being handled where someone is past the fingerprint testing, that record would be good for 5 years as a state employee or something like that, and then we wouldn't have to worry about storing fingerprint records. So I think that's something the ACLU and members could look into and might make this simplify this tremendously. So.
Thank you. We thought about that, but there are some other requirements from the FBI that make that impossible. That's my understanding. So
we could secede from the feds.
So with that, appreciate your testimony. Mark Lindauer, you wanted to make a comment? You said one comment in your note.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Holvey, Co-Chairs Wisnant, members of the committee. I'm Mark Lindauer. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon and just wanted to make a brief comment. I'd just like to draw your attention to line 6 and 7 of the first page of the bill, and I wanted to make sure that the record was clear on what the intent of this measure was, and the reading of the bill could lend one to believe that this work group would be looking at anybody who receives a license for background checks. I want to make sure that we're not talking about people, for example, who receive a driver's license in the state of Oregon. For example, what I believe this bill is directed towards are people who are required to have a criminal background check for the purposes of the license itself. Already authorized policy by the state to have a criminal background check. For example, a teacher, not somebody who's, for example, a plumber. Right. Or an electrician.
And I appreciate that language has been removed in the dash 6 amendment.
So it is very clear, and I just wanted to be sure on the record that that was the case for this bill. Thank you.
You bet. Up next, I'd like to call Andy Smith and Megan Moyer.
Chairs Holvey, Chair Woodsmith, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm with the Service Employee International Union, and I'm here testifying in favor of House Bill 4091, and I also want to give my support to the Dash 5 amendment. We really appreciate the hard work of Representative Nathanson and others at looking at this important issue around the duplicative background checks that are pervasive throughout state government. To give you an idea of the different entities of which my members work with, we have background checks for home care workers, which is one set of rules. We've got background checks for child care workers, which is another set of rules. We've got adult foster care providers, nursing home workers, on including state government workers. Many of the background checks run through the DHS's background check unit, who does fantastic work, and we continue to be very impressed with the moves forward that they are making, but they too are subject to the backlog, which is getting reports from the state police and their own ability and being swamped with the number of background checks. They actually exceed over 10,000 background checks a month. And we look forward to a work group that can find ways of reducing this burden. One example that I've shared with others in support of this effort is the issue that our adult foster care providers have. When it comes to long-term care facilities, you have to run a criminal background check when you work at a new facility. That doesn't matter if it's run by the same company or the same owner or it's across the street. Many adult foster care providers have more than one home. They often are the main provider in that home of care, but need to hire respite help depending on the needs of the clients or when they need a break. In order for them to do that, they have to run a criminal background check. Often that can take up to 6 weeks. If they then want that same worker to pick up some hours at the home across the street, they have to run another criminal background check, even if they did it 6 weeks ago. It's this type of story that really brings the need for House Bill 4891 to the forefront. We know that this is creating unnecessary workload for state government. We know that it's creating tremendous expense. And we really believe that, there is a better way. And that's why we're here supporting this bill. We'd also like to support the Dash 5 Amendment, which is asking that we apply for a grant through the Centers on Medicaid and Medicare for a wrap-back system. What wrap-back would allow Oregon to do is to really have portability of a criminal background check and provide greater safety for vulnerable Oregonians. Wrap-back is a system that an individual, once they have their criminal background check and are approved as a provider, would be put on a list that is periodically checked with the state police and the feds for new convictions. If no new arrests or convictions happen, they have a cleared background check in perpetuity. This allows us to have workers start working right away as long as they are still clean on the list. But it also allows, if somebody is arrested for or convicted of a crime that would really call into question the appropriateness of them remaining as a care provider in a given setting, we are alerted of it. Today, you can work, and if you don't change settings, you could work for 20, 30 years without a new criminal background check, regardless of what may have happened with convictions that would call to question your appropriateness as a care provider. This allows greater protection for vulnerable individuals, but it also allows workers portability and saves providers tremendous expense. So we are strongly in support of the Dash 5s and also really appreciate the hard work that went behind 4091 and hope that you will support it.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Andy Smith. I am here to testify today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We're a statewide organization that represents mental health directors in Oregon's 36 counties. We have 9 mental health organizations. They administer the Oregon Health Plan, the mental health benefit, as well as one tribe. And the realm that we deal in, it's mental health, addictions, as well as developmental disabilities. We strongly support the bill. To begin with, we'd like to acknowledge Representative Nathanson's leadership. This theme, this type of legislation, she's really been working at it for a long time. And again, this is one of many pieces that we've supported her on and are glad to do it. 5 quick themes that are contained in the bill that just want to kind of emphasize at a general level. We haven't reviewed the amendments, so I won't speak those today. One would be the timeliness issue, just this whole notion of how quickly do these things take. The task force could certainly look at that and make sure that in an efficient manner that that's happening. The ease of application itself, is there a simple and standardized process that's also thorough? This was a theme that Megan touched upon, the transferability, portability issue. When you change employers, maybe you change facilities, that certainly should be within the purview of the task force. The coordination of limited resources between entities, again, this is that silo discussion. And then to make sure that we're not missing the point, we think that the task force approach, makes a ton of sense to the degree that they can bring back recommendations with the target at the end of the day, the primary concern about background checks, that it is about the safety of the consumer and of the general public. Obviously, we have to keep sight on that. But we think there's a great amount of work that can be done in this area. Very happy to support the bill, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much. Questions of these two witnesses?
Really appreciate your testimony. I might just add, committee, that, we're in looking at all these different amendments, to the Dash 5 amendment specifically, the Wrap Back program certainly looks like it could provide us a lot of those efficiencies, though I think it may be premature for this committee to go down that road yet until we have solved the retention of records issues, which are still out there, because there are many requirements of a Wrap Back system that require the retention of records. Plus, it also requires matching funds from the state, which I've been told are very unlikely that we would get in this fiscal climate. So I think that it's a
it's got great potential, but it I think it's going to be the work of the work group, should it be instituted, to, you know, try to get us closer to being in a position to have a ratback system. I think there's still some issues yet to be solved. So, committee, we don't have any fiscal statements on these amendments as of yet. And when we come back, it's probably going to, you know, I have to discuss this with co-chair Wisnet, but I do not intend on moving the Dash 5 amendment. I will be supporting the Dash 3 amendment and the Dash 6 amendment. And the retention records in the Dash 9 amendment, I don't know that we're going to be able to move that either, but that one is still up for discussion. So with that, there's no one else signed up to testify, I believe, and I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4091. Yeah, I wanted to wait till Jean was okay. Back to do that. So we'll go ahead and move into House Bill 4001. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4001. Jan, would you give us a brief summary of House Bill 4001?
I will, Mr. Chair, committee members. House Bill 4001 requires fingerprint-based criminal records check for volunteers and employees who staff the Emergency Operations Center, the State Emergency Operations Center, or an emergency operating facility of a city or a county. It exempts those who have already undergone a criminal records check by their public employer, declares an emergency effective on passage. You have a Dash 1 amendment that extends the exemption to those with a state-issued professional license for which a criminal records check has been required. There's no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact, and the statement from fiscal office has been issued.
Thank you. We have Paul Evans, Dana Robinson, and Mike Caldwell. Ironic, committee, that we're looking for efficiencies in criminal background checks, but that may not be pertinent to the need to have them. And so before us, we have a whole other topic on the same topic. Yeah. Welcome. If you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, sir. I'm Co-Chair Holvey. Well, and members of the committee, and Co-Chair Wisnet when he gets back. For the record, my name is Paul Evans. I live at 744 East Main Street, Monmouth, Oregon, and as luck would have it, I, in fact, am talking about background checks after we just had that discussion earlier. So I know everybody is happy and excited about this topic, so I'm going to make it very quick, or at least as quick as I can make it. First, in most places around the state, this is already done, so we're not actually inventing a need, but a clarification because of changes in the way in which life occurs. Two, I'm here today as a citizen. I asked Representative Clem to offer it. He has no responsibility on this bill, so if it goes bad, it's not his fault. Completely my fault. And three, there are two things that a bill does, and quite frankly, those two things are awareness, and if action is needed, action. The good and the bad news is that once this became a real bill, and groups like some that are seated behind me in the back and to the left of me that aren't terribly happy about this bill, at least conversations that needed to happen have happened. Because the problem is this. We have volunteers and organizations inside emergency operations centers across the state, and in many cases, most of the volunteers and the full-time folks are there. They're doing a good job. They're working hard. As a former mayor of a small town that depended upon volunteers, please understand this is not an anti-volunteer discussion. What it is, rather, is actually to protect the volunteers, to protect the public, and to protect the information that is inside some of the emergency operations centers. Sometimes, depending on where they're at, it has access to law enforcement information, it has access to Social Security numbers, it has access to kinds of things that we want to be secure about. truth be told, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm no longer in the business of emergency management, or at least on the government side. However, as the letter that I submitted earlier states, when I was in the field as an officer, when you stumbled upon a problem, you didn't leave it for somebody else, because if you did, then it'd probably go boom and hurt somebody downrange, and that is dereliction of duty. So here's the deal. There is a problem. It doesn't happen often. There are a lot of systems in place. Each county may, in fact, be able to prove that they can do it without a law. But there are circumstances where people that have not had a solid vetting have access to information, and that's a problem. How you deal with that problem, that's the beautiful part. You're the elected legislature. But we do need to have a solution. Simply saying everything is fine and kind of whistling through the graveyard is really not the best answer on this one. So that's my comments. I will stop there, reply to any questions, and look forward to those that are going to talk against the bill.
So I think we'll listen to the rest of the testimony first. Whoever would like to go next.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department and the interim head of the Office of Emergency Management. Indeed, I think Paul's comments about having information on folks who volunteer is important, and I'm certainly not a bit negative toward that goal. There is a minimal cost even for the state. I think the larger cost, and we'll hear from the counties here in a second, will be at the county level. However, we have been struggling for the last several years, ever since probably the 96 floods. Those of you may recall the seawall down on the city of Portland, there were thousands of volunteers who self-deployed, came down and were working filling sandbags. Well, that goes across the board. What we learned in Katrina, we had many people show up, the state of Louisiana did, had people show up that claimed they were doctors, nurses, et cetera, and there was such a mess that they were actually out doing service. Come to find out, some of them had never been to medical school, or they went to the Juarez School of Medicine and Upholstery or whatever they did, but they did show up and pretend that they were doctors. So they were servicing people, and some of them did a pretty good job. So I think this whole business of having an emergency and having people show up to volunteer and to produce creates an automatic problem. We have looked at numerous different vehicles to try to credential people. Most everybody in state government wears a badge and ID of some sort that I think we all do now, that indicate, even at the county level, that indicate that they are legitimate. However, during the time of crisis, that's simply not going to happen. And the recently we had the event here in Marion County primarily, but on the coast as well. There were 32 volunteers who showed up in Marion County to help run 24/7 phone calls, and I think by and large there weren't any issues with that, and I think that's normally going to be the case. However, there are going to be incidents where people get involved where they shouldn't be, and they shouldn't be in those circumstances. We leave it up primarily from the state level. We look at the counties and the cities to take care of their own issues in that regard, and again, I think it's a matter of having the staff available to screen these people, do the processes and the costs that are going to be the biggest issue. I think if I was king for the day and we had the money, I would go to an emergency management certification process that we could certify everyone that would show up at whatever county and be legitimate in the database at the state level, so we know that was the case. Background checks certainly would be part of that. Sad part is, and we've looked at systems, and there's some very, very good systems out there right now, most of which sprung up after Katrina based on the incidents I described. And they're very effective, and they're not all that expensive, but when you do it statewide, 36 counties, now you're talking $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, and we just simply don't have the money to do that. So it's a want-to-do thing. It's something we should do. We don't disagree with that. It's a question of how do we implement it and what money we use to get it done. So I'll conclude my testimony with that.
Thank you. Welcome. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Welcome. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Dana Robinson. I'm the director for Clackamas County Emergency Management. Co-Chair Hovey and members of the committee, I greatly appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about House Bill 4001. We do have a few concerns about the bill. You have my written testimony before you, so I'll try to make my comments brief. Initially, it wasn't clear what this bill is intended to fix or prevent, but it's helpful to hear from Mr. Mr. Evans on his position to get some idea about that. I do want to talk a little bit about what we do with Clackamas County Emergency Management. The integrity of our security information is of paramount importance to us. Mr. Evans is correct in that we do manage oftentimes some secret information, some confidential information within an emergency operations center. But what we do in Clackamas County, and I think that this is done in other emergency operations centers in other counties, is that we segregate the information to the people on a sort of a need-to-know basis. We do background investigations on certain individuals within the emergency operations center, and we also have about 100 employees in Clackamas County that actually serve as volunteers in the emergency operations center, and some of them have background investigations as part of their day-to-day job, and others do not. We also background our amateur radio volunteers as well. So it's a mixture, but we are very careful about how we manage our information within the Emergency Operations Center. The bill does create some problems in that it's silent on a few things. It doesn't talk about how the information from the criminal check would be used. Would it be unlawful for anyone with any kind of criminal background to work in an Emergency Operations Center at all? You know, to what level? Class C misdemeanor, is that going to be okay? A felony record? Okay, that might be a problem. But where will the line be drawn? Some emergency operations centers in Oregon do use representatives from the private sector, other governmental agencies, NGOs, and so forth. By the way the bill is written, are those considered volunteers or are those considered paid staff? Not real clear. It also talks about how the Emergency Management Office will ask the sheriff to conduct these background investigations. Right now, many of emergency managers in Oregon contract for their background investigations, and they may not use the sheriff. So does that mean that those backgrounds are no longer good and we need to repeat those at a cost and put a burden of both time and money on the sheriff and then potentially seek cost recovery? So there's quite a few issues that I think still would probably need to be addressed. But I'm familiar with some of the challenges that Mr. Evans brings forward. I've had the unfortunate opportunity of being able to have or having to make decisions about who works in the Clackamas County Emergency Operations Center. And ultimately, that comes down to my decision. I review when each person comes in, whether they have a background. I've denied people from working in the Emergency Operations Center based on my own authority, whether some of them have had backgrounds, some of them have not. We have people that come in from all different other departments, firefighter agencies, law enforcement agencies help out in the Emergency Operations Center. And when the really big thing happens, we need all hands on deck. We don't need one of our deputy sheriffs sitting at a desk going through a long line of people that are standing out in the snow waiting to go through a background investigation. We need those people to come in and work, and we need to make decisions about where they most appropriately should work in the Emergency Operations Center, and then carefully segregate confidential information. In summary, we don't feel that at the county level that this should be a county city level versus a legal change, and the integrity of an Emergency Operations Center is a local responsibility. And I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. Questions from the committee for this panel? Representative Caldwell, another comment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just one last thing that occurred to me when we were listening to the testimony from the county. I think that clearly the previous bill, I think, has great merit. We just had a great discussion on that. I think it's, if we don't go with this, then I'd recommend that we be rolled into that work group that's going to be headed by DAS, assuming that bill passes, and this subject be part of that whole discussion, because it does impact not only the military department in total, because we have a high school, 24/7 high school in Bend, and we have background checks. I had to get special legislation in order to get that in there so we could actually do those kind of checks. So I think we deserve to be at that table as well if you decide not to go with this, to talk about both issues.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'll take that, you know, under advisement and talk. It's not exactly the purview of that work group, but certainly there is a lot of crossover there. And I believe if that work group were instituted, it would probably be open to the public as well. So with that, I really appreciate the topic.
sounds like, you know, there's still a few things to work out on this one at this point, but I think it is something that we need to take seriously and try to address.
Co-Chair Hovey, members of the committee, I just wanted to say thank you again. It may not be readily apparent, but in some counties that are not quite as advanced and as fully staffed as those that are here today, this discussion topic has been throughout the state over the last week and a half. So though it may not look like it now, the conversations are helpful. So thank you.
Appreciate that.
Sponsor the bill. Right
with
there.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4001.
Are you
thinking and we'll stand at ease for just a moment so I can
right. We'll give them.
60.
I'd like to bring to order the back into order of the House Committee on General Government, Consumer Protection. After a brief recess to test our equipment, we're now back, and I would like to open a work session on House Bill 4131.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash four amendments to House Bill 4131.
You're going to need a vote.
You need your vote.
I'll go get
them. Representative Wisnett has moved the adopt the dash four amendment into House Bill 4131. Is there discussion?
Sounds like a wonderful idea.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the dash four amendment dated 2/7/2012 is adopted to House Bill 4131.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4131 as amended to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, or subsequent to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Wisnett has moved House Bill 4131 as amended to the floor with a subsequent to Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion? Representative Clem.
4131, right?
Yeah.
Just one comment I haven't made the entire time. I'm going to vote for it, and I support it, but I do feel a slight bit of obligation as the person who represents probably most of the people who would be affected by this to say that they're not all, you know, they have functions and missions, and we all have to refine and function, but they're not just mindless human beings who don't do anything, and I just would like to say at some level that doing arbitrary numbers does sometimes impact real people who were serving a valuable function, and so I just want to say that. I still think it's good to have goals, but they are my constituents after all.
Representative
Sheehan.
This is me being paranoid again, but I just want to say that the legislative intent of this is to actually shrink government, not to staff up to a 1-to-11 ratio. I just want to get that out there and state it for the record.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's pretty clearly stated in the amendments how that is achieved. So with that, I don't know if Representative Cameron was coming back or not.
Okay. He's coming. I mean, his stuff here.
He wandered quite a ways down there.
So with that, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative
Tim.
Sheehan. No, Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
You missed.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Holden.
Miss Gregg. Miss Gregg.
Can we call Representative Matthews?
Nah.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Would not have.
And Co-Chair Holby votes aye as well.
Third person.
Bob Dole. For the record. House Bill 4131, having received the vote, is moved to the floor and to Ways and Means by prior reference. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 4131 and open a work session on House Bill 4091.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash threes into be adopted into House Bill 4091.
Representative Wisnett moves the dash three amendments dated.
I have no idea.
Everything is shuffled around here. Hold on.
Three and six.
Dated January 30th, 2012, be adopted into House Bill 4091.
Discussion.
Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the dash three amendments are adopted to House Bill 4091. Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Chair, I move dash sixes be adopted into House Bill 4091.
What is that?
Dated February the 7th, 2012.
Representative Wisnett moves the dash 6 amendment be dated 2/7/2012 be adopted into House Bill 4091. Any discussion? Any objections?
Just to be clear, I want to be clear, these are the consensus amendments that we're adding right now.
Well, if you vote for them so far, there'll be consensus.
It remains to be seen as a fine answer, but I just, you know, I think it was, you know, whatever.
Thank you.
It's a great discussion I've had with myself.
Seeing no objections, dash 6 amendments are adopted to House Bill 4091. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 4091.
What are we voting on?
Let's suspend the rules to allow Kevin Cameron to
I move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Cameron to cast a ballot on House Bill 4131.
Is this on adopting the amendments or on actually on the amended version?
This is
Moving the amended version to
Ways and Means.
Of House Bill 4131.
I vote aye.
Before you get there, Representative Smith moved for suspension of rules to allow Representative Cameron to vote on House Bill 4131. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Cameron, how do you vote?
Vote aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, members. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 4131. With that, I think we're ready to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4111. And we have just a few minutes, so we'll undertake to do that. Representative Widener, would you like to go down to the dais and talk to us a little bit briefly? We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left. This bill will be carried over to Friday, obviously, at this point. But if you could describe the newest amendment that you have for this bill.
Mr. Chair, or General Holvey, representatives of this wonderful committee. This is just a simple amendment.
You just try to keep your humor to yourself while testifying in public.
So, simple amendment that we have here is that we got with all the different parties. If you look at the dash 2 amendments, they should have been passed out to you and everything. But the big issue that we're trying to get out is in line 6, where it says, but not exceeding the unpaid lien or final assessment. That has been the biggest problem in the legislation. We've corrected that and taken care of a few other issues that we were running into with cities and counties. They're sitting behind us. They're all on board. And I think that's summing up nice and simple. If I don't think there's anybody in opposition to it, which I wasn't sure if we'd get there or not, but things are looking very good for this bill right now.
Thank you for that definitive explanation of the dash 2 amendments. Mr. Honeycutt, could you introduce yourself for the record?
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. This is the second public hearing on this bill. The issue in front of the committee and what this bill tries to do is deal with situations where there's a foreclosure sale on a lien from a local improvement district. Excuse me. Under the current law, when an LID is formed and the assessments are made and the assessments aren't paid by the property owner, the district or the city can foreclose on that lien, and they're prohibited under current law from accepting a bid that exceeds the amount of the lien. And so a property owner who may have substantial equity in their home, but for one reason or the other cannot pay the lien for the local improvement, for the assessment for the local improvement district, can lose that the entire equity if the district or the city forecloses on that lien. We had an example, you heard testimony, and there was an example from a brother and sister in Eugene who lost their home as a result of a $7,000 lien for sidewalk improvements. They owned their home. home that was free and clear, except for this assessment. But they were elderly. They were on Social Security. The amount of the assessment for the sidewalk improvements was $7,000, and they couldn't afford to pay the $7,000 lien. So the city foreclosed on the lien, and at the foreclosure sale, could not accept a bid in excess of the $7,000. As a result, a bid was made for the $7,000. The property was sold, and this elderly brother and sister lost their home and all of the equity therein. This bill is designed to remedy that. Representative Widener and I have tortured legislative counsel for the last couple of days with amendments to get all the parties on board. We've worked with the lenders, we've worked with the cities, we've worked with the counties. There's an additional amendment that the realtors and the title insurance folks wanted. I believe it's in section 4 of the Dash 2 amendments. Everybody is on board. What the amendments will do is guarantee that if a foreclosure sale takes place, that the city or the district that's conducting the sale will be required to offer the property for at least 75% of the assessed value. If there's a bid that exceeds that 75% of the current assessed value of the property, then the property can be sold. The amount of the lien will be paid plus the cost of the sale. Any junior lien holders, mortgage company, anybody else, will be paid from the additional surplus, and anything after all the lien holders have been paid will go to the equity holder, to the property owner, him or herself. We think, and if no bid is received for at least 75%, the greater of at least 75% of the value, assessed value of the property, or the amount of the lien, whichever one of those two is greater, then the city will has the district that's foreclosing on the lien has the ability to wait 90 days and conduct another sale, do it all over again until at some point the property will sell or the property will be transferred, and then the liens will be satisfied. So I think this is a good little bill that I think ensures that property owners who are put in the position of having a large lien for a local improvement district that they may not have wanted and may not be able to afford have some protection if the lien if they can't pay the lien and the city moves to foreclose on the lien.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I'm glad that you worked with the stakeholders to get to this point. And I can't speak for the rest of the committee, but the underlying bill addressed certain statutes, and so I do have concern with section four that has been brought forward with no explanation, where they are eliminating the address requirement under ORS 205-234. That was not a part of the original bill at all, and has been added to this. And I fail to understand what it has to do with this particular bill. And can you share with me exactly why that is happening?
Co-Chair Wisnant, I see Mr. Jillians, or I hear Mr. Jillians in the back. The amendments, the requests have came from him. So if with the co-chair's indulgence, maybe he could explain the...
Okay. We'll have Sean Jillians come forward.
Explain yourself.
And I apologize. I just hate to jeopardize a bill that seemed like it was going through, and all of a sudden, at the last minute, there's something brand new that I haven't seen get thrown in there, and it gives me enough pause to, you know, question the bill at this point.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, which, of course, has nothing to do with your pause, I'm sure, Mr. Co-Chair, of who introduced the amendment. last session, as you're very familiar with, Senate Bill 382 went through, which dealt with construction lien law, and it put in a requirement that for construction lien holders, the address be included there when the documents were recorded. Folks who held a construction lien felt like they weren't being properly notified when foreclosures were going on. Inadvertently, the bill changed one other section, which is what you see in Section 4, which is said for any recorded mortgage document on the cover page, now the address requirement was required for the grantor and the grantee, basically the borrower and the lender. So now, because of that bill, not only did all the construction lien holders have to have their addresses recorded in the document, but for some reason it was included on the cover page, specifically the cover page, not the remainder of the document. On the cover page, we had to have the address of the borrower and the lender, which obviously is in the document anyway. So the problem that we have been seeing, we've worked with the Land Title Association, the bar, the counties, I think they're all in here, is that documents are not recording on time because of the failure to just put the address of the borrower, which is not a critical piece of information, on the cover sheet, Mr. Chair. And so it's a simple amendment I bring to you today, which just removes the address requirement on the cover sheet for the borrower and the lender. That's all the amendment does. It does not tinker with any of your other construction lien law changes that you made last time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for that explanation. Just wanted to make sure we knew what we were doing. So, any other questions?
I still trust him.
No questions?
Should have made Fiscom come up here.
Is there anybody else that wishes to testify on?
Put on the record, cities or counties like that.
And Mr. Eliason as well, could you come up?
Here, put it on the record.
My co-chair has a question for the two of you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for coming. Just please identify yourself and put on the record your support of the bill or neutral position.
For the record, I am Scott Lincoln, representing the League of Oregon Cities, and as Ed was indicated by previous testimony, League of Oregon Cities would like to thank Representative Widener for addressing our concerns, and we do offer our support for the legislation.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. We're comfortable with the underlying bill and wholeheartedly support the Section 4 amendment. We do believe that the additional statute where the address requirement was added appears to have been inadvertent. It does require, in our interpretation, our county's interpretation, the address requirement on basically just about everything that's recorded when the intent was to limit it to the construction lien sections. So we do wholeheartedly support just the simple fix of taking away the address requirement in 205-234. Thanks.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Dave Fiscom here, representing the Oregon Land Title Association. I want to associate myself with the remarks of Sean Jillians, if it helps you to have me here. Instead of just Sean, that's great. If I detract from Mr. Jillians, I'll be happy to leave. But we do support this bill wholeheartedly. I want to thank Mr. Honeycutt for being willing to work with us for this simple change that Mr. Jillians has well outlined. The Oregon Land Title Association, which consists of all the land title companies throughout the state, wholeheartedly supports this change. So thank you for allowing me to say that for the record.
Good. You bet. Any other questions of this panel?
Thank you.
Not seeing any. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4111, and I would like to carry over House Bill 4111 to Friday, February 10th, and carry over House Bill 4091 to February 10th, and we can carry over House Bill 4001 as well to February 10th. With that, I will adjourn the House Committee on General Government, Consumer Protection.
Still alive? My House Bill 4001 just